Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I want to talk to Jeffrey Stone. He's a professor of law at the University of Chicago about two topics. First, this is a clip from the CBS Morning News, and they were talking about the fact that that guy sent those letter bombs to a dozen or more people now. And the question became, since he was posting on that Gab website all of his hate-filled anti-Semitism, since he was clearly a deranged individual, since he was posting pictures of his guns and saying things like Jews are the children of Satan, why doesn't the federal government, why doesn't the FBI monitor this? People knew that this guy was deranged and armed. This is a clip from their national security guest expert on CBS.
So one of the things that people don't appreciate is the FBI doesn't monitor social media sites. They're restricted from doing that under what's called the Attorney General guidelines. And so I think it's time that we've got to look at that. If people are making these statements in public, it's sort of the town crier in the local square. Why can't the FBI look at it? I understand the civil rights and free speech concerns, but I think it's time we have to deal with the problem that's in front of us.
Fran Townsend, but then they said, but the FBI is not allowed to do that. Jeff Stone joins us from the U of C. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Delighted to be here.
What's your thought about that clip we just played?
Well, I think that the reason why the FBI does not monitor these websites is because the speech on those websites is protected by the First Amendment. As offensive as it might be to some people, offense is in the eye of the beholder, and some people are more offended by some speech than others are offended by others. But the bottom line is all of that is protected by the First Amendment. And for the government to be in the business of deciding to monitor the speech of individuals to see whether their speech in there that the government thinks is potentially dangerous would have an enormous chilling effect on the willingness of people to express themselves in ways that the First Amendment protects. So it would be as if, for example, there was a rally held by a particular political cause, and the government came and used cameras to take pictures of everyone who was at the rally and put those pictures in their database so they could know who was at that rally, because maybe that would be useful to them in some kind of criminal prosecution in the future. Well, we don't do that, because that would deter people from going to political rallies that they otherwise would want to do. So the government has to have a more focused, more specific justification for monitoring speech in that way. And that's basically an important hallmark of our democracy.
So when we have a Black Lives Matter rally in Chicago, or we have a women's rights, a Me Too rally in Chicago, I attended that one with a lot of other people, and you know, there's no reason for the government to be taking our pictures there. But what if they took the pictures of the people in Charlottesville and said, it'll be nice to know who these skinheads are? I see those as very similar kind of political statements, but it's pretty easy to know who are the bad guys. It's the skinheads in Charlottesville. So I'll ask you to tell me why it would be a bad idea for the government to take the pictures of those bad dudes down there.
Because, first of all, because bad guys is a subjective judgment in these situations. And you could say Black Lives Matter individuals are potentially bad guys because they might resort to violence in order to pursue their ends, or pro-abortion people or anti-abortion people might resort to violence in order to pursue their ends, or Trump supporters might resort to violence so we can monitor Trump rallies. And the bottom line is you don't want the government to have the power to make those decisions, and with the consequences it would have for free speech. It's not that one couldn't gather potentially useful information by doing this, but the fact is that there are many ways in which we limit the government's ability to gather potentially useful information because doing so intrudes upon other important interests. So, you know, the government could basically wiretap all of us all the time and listen to our phone calls or open up all of our mail and see, you know, who we're getting mail from. And it could go into all of our houses and search for illegal weapons. But we don't let the government do that unless it has probable cause to believe that there is a crime afoot. And that's not the case in these circumstances where people are talking about things that you and I might find hateful, but which the probability that anyone you doing that on this particular website will actually go out and commit a violent crime is in fact very small. And therefore, we want to protect the rights of individuals in that context in the same way we do in the others that I gave. And it does mean that we're less effective than we might otherwise be at law enforcement, but that's what it means to have a democracy.
I understand that in principle, but boy, oh boy, you got a guy saying Jews are bad. I'm going in, quote unquote. Here's pictures of my guns.
This is what people said about communists. Basically, they said, well, you know, you can't have communists working for the government because they might be, you know, someone who is a member of the Communist Party or who attended a rally for the Communist Party or reads magazines that are published by the Communist Party or that reads magazines that are supportive of the Communist Party. You can't have them in any government position because they may turn out to be traitors and they may engage in espionage. So we got to keep them all out. It's the same logic.
In the words of Aaron Sorkin, democracy is hard. You know, sometimes
yes,
you
is.
Have to say, okay, this principle is really important, and academically you understand it. Then some dum-dum shoots up a place or sends bombs to people, and you go, well, we should have seen this coming. Why aren't you guys doing something about it in advance? And that's the hard part. In order to protect everybody else's liberty, you have to sometimes let those ones slip through the cracks. I mean, okay, there's my little speech. Did I get it right? Is that the deal we're making here?
Precisely.
Talk to me about, and by the way, I don't know that, you and I are about to move on. I don't know how persuasive we were or you were in that case because it's very frustrating to everybody else can see. I mean, it's not like he's sneaking around. He's posting these on public forums. So I don't think that it's a great sort of incursion by the federal government into my private life. I'm posting it on a public forum. If the FBI was just monitoring hate speech or hateful speech, and weapons displays, you could almost imagine some algorithm that's going to find these people in advance. I'm not sure that everybody's persuaded that that's such a bad idea.
Well, one of the reasons we don't prohibit hate speech in this country, is, among others, is that hate speech is often in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, what you regard as hate speech, somebody else may not. In those countries in Western Europe, for example, that prohibit hate speech, those laws are most often enforced, ironically, against the groups that were meant to be the intended beneficiaries of those laws. Because the people in the majority who actually control the law enforcement don't like it when black people say things about white people that they don't like. And so the danger in this is, do you trust the government? You know, do you trust, in this case, the Trump administration to be monitoring free speech to decide who's dangerous and who's not? If they really did it in exactly the right way, that might not be so bad. But the question is, do you trust them to do it in exactly the right way?
Jeff Stone's at the University of Chicago. He's a professor of law, constitutional law. So this is the president, speaking of him, talking about birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment.
Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it has to end.
Have you talked about that with counsel?
Yeah, I have.
So where in the process?
It's in the process. It'll happen. With an executive order. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah,
that's
exactly
very interesting.
What I'm talking
about. I didn't think anybody but knew that but me. I thought I was the only one. Jonathan,
I've got a good guess.
It'll happen, he says. What about that, Jeff?
But to be honest, this is completely idiotic. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution provides that any person born in the United States is a citizen of the United States. That's the law of our nation. In fact, there are some 30 other nations who have a similar law. His notion that we're the only one who does this is completely wrong. One can think it's a good or bad policy. One can argue we should change it, but there's only one way to change it, and that's by amending the Constitution. An executive order, which is hardly equivalent to amending the Constitution, except perhaps in Trump's mind, is not a constitutional way of accomplishing that. So if it's a good idea, which I don't think it is, but if it's a good idea to change birthright citizenship, there's only one way to do it, and that's to amend the Constitution of the United States.
I don't know what he has up his sleeve. I don't know what counsel is advising him on this. Clearly, the smart people in the room know about the 14th Amendment. I'm reading it in front of me right now, and it says all persons, think about this, all persons born in the United States or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside period. There's more language, but I mean, that's pretty unequivocal there.
It is unequivocal, and it's always been understood that way, and the Supreme Court in the past has said that's exactly what it means. And there is simply no credible argument. Who Trump is talking to about this, I have no idea.
Okay, but I have an idea on this, and that is that when that was written, it wasn't anticipating immigrants. It was talking about slaves who were in the South, and they were not citizens of the United States. And after the Civil War, they were. So those people who were born in the United States to parents who were not citizens are now citizens. But it was about emancipating slaves. So I wonder if there's the angle. It was written about that, but it wasn't written about this, and some lawyer's going to find a way to finesse a new reading on that, and the court will see it their way. What do you make of that?
Well, the 14th Amendment could be limited when they wrote it to slaves. It was not. They very self-consciously wrote it in a way that was much broader than that. So also within the 14th Amendment, it says no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. That applies to you and me, even though we were not slaves. And it applies to all sorts of people who were not slaves. And the same thing is true of this provision. So it's true that what they had in mind when they enacted the 14th Amendment was they were acting in a world in which there had been slavery, and this was designed to eliminate that, but it went beyond that. And it did a whole series of things that go way beyond that. And no one has ever suggested that no state shall deny equal protection of laws to any person is limited only to slaves. And it's the same point. I mean, this was written in a much broader way. Consciously and intentionally was written in that way. They could easily have limited it if they wanted to slaves, but they clearly did not. So this is just not even an interesting legal question, to be perfectly honest.
Well, not only is this absurd, it's not even interesting to you because it's just so impossible. But all right, listen just for a moment to the confidence with which the president answers their question.
Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it has to end.
Have you talked about that with counsel?
Yeah, I have.
So where in the process?
It's in the process. It'll happen.
Sounds like he knows something you and I don't.
No, it sounds like he doesn't know anything. This is really not controversial. This is an absolute open and shut black and white question.
Do you have any colleagues at the U of C? Could I find somebody that will give me a credible argument the other way?
I doubt it, honestly. I honestly doubt it. I mean, it seems to me that this has been understood from the time the 14th Amendment was adopted. Everyone has acted on this assumption that that's what it meant. It's clear that that is what the language says unequivocally. If you're somebody who believes in textualism, as Trump would say his judicial appointments do, this is what the text says. And no, I don't think anyone would credibly argue that this means anything other than what it explicitly says. And of course, you can amend the Constitution.
Yeah,
and
right.
That's the way you.
Well, that's what I'm thinking because
things.
You know, I think most people like me, and it sounds like you, would agree that we should continue to allow birthright citizenship to people. Although, to be honest with you, if we started all over again, I see this sort of incongruity of it. It doesn't really make sense, does it? That children born to people who are not citizens are therefore citizens. You would think the birthright would be from the parentage, not from the geography. And that's what we do in this country. I mean, really, what is the sense of that, right?
Well, again, despite what the president says, my understanding is that many other countries, in fact, do this. And the notion is simply, how do you decide who we are? And one of the definitions of we are people born in our country. A part of who we are. That's how you define the community. Now, you don't have to do it that way. I agree. You could do it differently. You could say that only the children of parents who were citizens of the United States are citizens of the United States. Or you could say that only children of parents who were born in the United States. So if you go out of the country and you give birth to a child in France, you might say, well, that child's not a citizen of the United States because they weren't born here, right?
Oh.
And there are lots of ways you could define this, in other words. But this is the way our Constitution defines it, for better or worse. And if we don't agree with that, there's a way to change it. You amend the Constitution. The president cannot do this by executive order. That's ludicrous.
Jeff Stone's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Hey, Jeff, you and I haven't spoken before. You're terrific. I appreciate your time, and we'll visit with you again, sir.
My pleasure. Anytime.